Well, hi, and welcome to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm volunteer reader Steve Veach. Thanks for tuning in. During the next hour, you will hear articles from the February 1st through February 7th edition of the magazine. On the cover this week, an illustration of the world. Very simple, just green and blue. And the globe is wearing a surgical mask, which bears the image of the Chinese flag. The headline, How Bad Will It Get? The feature article, Made in China, Will the Wuhan Virus Become a Pandemic? Probably, but public health services can help determine how severe it turns out to be. Then we'll hear this week's briefing, the first of two items on the Brexit subject, The Special Relationship, A Weaker Post-Brexit Britain Looks to America. Good luck with that. Then, more on the Brexit story, and this actually the feature article in the UK edition of the magazine, Uncharted Waters, Britain After Brexit. Now that Britain is sailing alone, Boris Johnson needs a lodestar. Liberalism offers one. Also, dead on arrival, Donald Trump's one-sided peace plan. The need for new leadership on all sides has never been so clear. And finally, Goldman Sachs, how the mighty Goldman has fallen. The bank's search for a new identity captures the changes in global banking. But we'll begin, as always, with highlights from the world this week. In business this week, the problems mounted at Boeing as it more than doubled the cost it expects to incur from the grounding of the 737 MAX airliner to $18.6 billion. The aerospace company reported a net loss of $636 million for 2019, its first annual loss in 22 years. The amount of debt it holds is ratcheting up, and it is cutting production of the Dreamliner. To cap it all, Boeing took a $410 million charge in the fourth quarter because its Starliner unmanned spacecraft failed to dock with the International Space Station on its maiden voyage. By contrast, Apple reported record quarterly sales and profit figures. Revenue was up by 9% in the last 3 months of 2019, compared with the same quarter a year earlier, to $91.8 billion. That generated a net profit of $22.2 billion. Sales of the iPhone rebounded after several quarters of moribund growth. Apple is expected to release its first 5G phones later this year. The company's share price jumped, pushing its market capitalization to above $1.4 trillion. Along with many other companies, Apple warned about the potential impact of the coronavirus on its business. It has mitigation plans to counter the loss of production from its suppliers in Wuhan, the center of the virus, but is uncertain about its supply from elsewhere in China. Foxconn, which assembles most of Apple's iPhones in China, saw its share price plunge. Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, said that the spreading coronavirus would probably cause some disruption to the global economy, but that it was unclear how far that would extend. The Fed left its benchmark interest rate unchanged at a rate between 1.5% and 1.75%. The Japanese government sent a strong signal that it remains committed to its program of quantitative easing and negative interest rates by nominating Adachi Seiji to the policy board of the Bank of Japan. Mr. Adachi is an ardent reflationist who wants to ease monetary policy even further in order to achieve the central bank's 2% inflation target. But as in other countries, the financial industry is becoming louder in pointing out the drawbacks to its business of long-term negative rates. The Quarterly Pounder. McDonald's said that like-for-like sales rose by 5.9% last year, the biggest such jump in a decade. The fast food chain has revamped its menu and outlets and has benefited from being included on a growing number of food delivery apps. Britain decided that it would not ban high-risk vendors from parts of its 5G network. despite the generic language, the decision is mostly about Huawei, which will thus be able to continue supplying equipment despite an intense lobbying effort by American officials to block the Chinese firm on national security grounds. Half recognizing that concern, Britain will monitor Huawei's equipment and bar it from parts of the network deemed critical for security or safety. Elsewhere, its market share will be limited to 35%. In politics this week, a new coronavirus continued to spread rapidly in China. Several large cities were locked down in the Hubei province, whose capital, Wuhan, is where the virus broke out. Streets emptied, people stayed home. However, Wuhan's mayor said that 5 million people had left the city before the quarantine was imposed, some for their usual Chinese New Year trips, others to escape the virus. Some airlines canceled flights to and from China. Many countries, including America, Britain, and Japan, took steps to evacuate their citizens from China. Some businesses scaled back or closed their operations in the country. Cases of Wuhan virus have been detected outside China. Human-to-human transmissions were reported in Germany, Japan, Vietnam, and Taiwan. Stock markets shivered when it became clear that the disease is spreading rapidly. The S&P 500 had its worst day since October. India partially restored internet access in the Kashmir Valley, where it has been blocked since August. But the authorities are only allowing Kashmiris to visit 301 whitelisted websites. Social media services remain banned, and mobile data speeds have been deliberately reduced. The government says the measures are needed to impede terrorism. Authorities in Pakistan arrested Manzoor Pashtun, the head of the Pashtun Protection Movement, which has campaigned for justice for victims of military abuses. He has been charged with sedition, among other crimes. Several supporters protesting against his detention were also arrested. Bolton Wanderers. Democrats pushed their case for witnesses to give evidence in the impeachment trial of Donald Trump. They hoped to call John Bolton, the president's former national security advisor, who has claimed in a forthcoming book that Mr. Trump explicitly withheld military aid from Ukraine to press its government to investigate Joe Biden and his son. The claim is a central plank of the case against Mr. Trump, which he denies. Possibly to take his mind off the impeachment trial and shore up support among ardent pro-lifers, Mr. Trump gave a speech at the annual March for Life anti-abortion rally in Washington, the first president to do so. In a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court let stand a new immigration rule that could stop legal migrants from becoming permanent residents if they use public welfare programs, such as food stamps. Up the garden path. Donald Trump's peace plan for Israel and the Palestinians gave Israel most of what it wanted, such as a green light to annex occupied lands in the West Bank straight away. The Palestinians got conditional promises of something like a state and billions of dollars in investment at some point in the future. They instantly rejected the deal. The American embassy in Baghdad was struck by 3 rockets, wounding 3 people. America has blamed Iran and its proxies for an increase in attacks on American forces and facilities in Iraq. Heavy fighting broke out in Libya between forces loyal to the unbacked government, which is supported by Turkey, and soldiers under the command of Khalifa Haftar, who is supported by Russia, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates. Despite an arms embargo, weapons are pouring in. And finally, the biggest infestation of locusts for at least 25 years wrought havoc on East Africa. Heavy rains last year created ideal conditions for the pests. An adult locust can eat its own weight each day. So now we know that. And those are some highlights from the world this week. We go now to the feature article, Made in China. Will the Wuhan virus become a pandemic? Probably, but public health services can help determine how severe it turns out to be. Two things explain why a new infectious disease is so alarming. One is that, at first, it spreads exponentially. As tens of cases become hundreds and hundreds become thousands, the mathematics run away with you, conjuring speculation about a healthcare collapse, social and economic upheaval, and a deadly pandemic. The other is profound uncertainty. Sparse data and conflicting reports mean that scientists cannot rule out the worst case, and that lets bad information thrive. So it is with a new coronavirus known as 2019 nCoV, which has struck in China. The number of reported cases grew from 282 on January 20th to almost 7,800 just 9 days later. In that time, 4 reported cases outside mainland China have multiplied to 105 in 19 territories. And just a bit of disclosure here, this is being recorded on Friday morning the 7th at about 10:30, and the reported total number of cases in China has now cleared 31,000. Now back to the article. Doubt clouds fundamental properties of the disease, including how it is passed on and what share of infected people die. Amid the uncertainty, a simulation of a coronavirus outbreak by Johns Hopkins University in October, in which 65 million people lost their lives, was put about as a prediction. It is not. Those are the right questions, though. Will the new virus become a global disease? How deadly will it be? A definite answer is weeks or months away, but public health authorities have to plan today. The best guess is that the disease has taken hold in China and there is a high risk that it spreads around the world. It may even become a recurrent seasonal infection. It may turn out to be no more lethal than the seasonal influenza, but that would still count as serious. In the short term, that would hit the world economy and, depending on how the outbreak is handled, it could also have political effects in China. The outbreak began in December. The repeated mingling of people and animals in China means that viral mutations that infect humans are likely to arise there, and mass migration to cities means that they are likely to spread between people. This virus probably originated in bats and passed through mammals such as palm civets or ferret badgers, ending up in Wuhan's wet market where wild animals were on sale. Symptoms resemble flu, but can include pneumonia, which may be fatal. About 20% of reported cases are severe and need hospital care. About 2% of them have been fatal. As yet, there is no vaccine or antiviral treatment. The greatest uncertainty is how many cases have gone unrecorded. Primary health care is rudimentary in China, and some of the ill either avoided or were turned away from busy hospitals. Many more may have such mild symptoms that they do not realize that they have the disease. Modeling by academics in Hong Kong suggests that, as of January 25th, tens of thousands of people have already been infected and that the epidemic will peak in a few months' time. If so, the virus is more widespread than thought, and hence it will be harder to contain within China. But it will also prove less lethal because the number of deaths should be measured against a much larger base of infections. As with flu, a lot of people could die nonetheless. In 2017-18, a bad flu season saw symptoms in 45 million Americans and 61,000 deaths. Scientists have started work on vaccines and on treatments to make infections less severe. These are 6 to 12 months away, so the world must fall back on public health measures. In China, that has led to the biggest quarantine in history, as Wuhan and the rest of Hubei province have been sealed off. The impact of such draconian measures has rippled throughout China. The spring holiday has been extended, keeping schools and businesses closed. The economy is running on the home delivery of food and goods. Many experts praise China's efforts. Certainly, its scientists have coped better with the Wuhan virus than they did with SARS in 2003, rapidly detecting it, sequencing its genome, licensing diagnostic kits, and informing international bodies. China's politicians come off less well. They left alone the cramped markets filled with wild animals that spawned SARS. With the new virus, local officials in Wuhan first played down the science, and then, when the disease had taken hold, enacted the draconian quarantine fully 8 hours after announcing it, allowing perhaps 1 million potentially infectious people to leave the city first. That may have undermined a measure which is taking a substantial toll. China's growth in the first quarter could fall to as little as 2%, from 6% before the outbreak. As China accounts for almost a fifth of the world output, there will probably be a noticeable dent on global growth. Though the economy will bounce back when the virus fades, the reputation of the Communist Party, and even of Xi Jinping, may be more lastingly affected. The party claims that, armed with science, it is more efficient at governing than democracies. The heavy-handed failure to contain the virus suggests otherwise. Outside China, such quarantines are unthinkable. The medical and economic cost will depend on governments slowing the disease's spread. The way to do this is by isolating cases as soon as they crop up and tracing and quarantining people that victims have been in contact with. Indeed, if the disease burns out in China, that might yet stop the pandemic altogether. If, by contrast, that proves inadequate, they could shut schools, discourage travel, and urge the cancellation of public events. Buying time in this way has advantages, even if it does not completely stop the disease. Healthcare systems would have a greater chance to prepare for the onslaught and to empty beds that are now full of people with seasonal flu. Despite all those efforts, the epidemic could still be severe. Some health systems in Africa and the slums of Asia's vast cities will not be able to isolate patients and trace contacts. Much depends on whether people are infectious when their symptoms are mild or before they show any at all, as some reports suggest, because such people are hard to spot, and also on whether the virus mutates to become more transmissible or lethal. The world has never responded as rapidly to a disease as it has to the 2019 nCoV. Even so, the virus may still do great harm. As humans encroach on new habitats, farm more animals, gather in cities, travel, and warm the planet, new diseases will become more common. One estimate puts their cost at $60 billion a year. SARS, MERS, Nipah, Zika, Mexican swine flu, the fever from Wuhan is the latest of a bad bunch. It will not be the last. You just heard the feature article, Made in China. Will the Wuhan virus become a pandemic? Probably. But public health services can help determine how severe it turns out to be. We turn now to this week's briefing on the special relationship. A weaker post-Brexit Britain looks to America. Good luck with that. The titans of Brexit have a tendency to gush over Britain's bond with America. Before the referendum in 2016, Boris Johnson, now Prime Minister, then Mayor of London, predicted that, outside the European Union, the thriving British would be, quote, even better and more valuable allies of the United States, end quote. Britain's relationship with America had long been special, enthused Liam Fox as Trade Secretary in 2018. But Brexit provided a, quote, once-in-a-generation opportunity to raise it to a new level, end quote. Yet, in the week that Britain actually leaves the EU, it finds itself at loggerheads with America on tax, trade, and technology. If the British government persists with plans for a digital services tax that would hit tech giants, America has said it will retaliate with punitive tariffs on British car exports. And despite heavy American lobbying and suggestions that the country's intelligence sharing could be at risk, Mr. Johnson decided on January 28th to allow Britain to buy 5G telecoms kit from Huawei of China. Mike Pompeo, America's Secretary of State, had warned against letting China, quote, control the Internet of the future, end quote. The decision on Huawei came 2 days before Mr. Pompeo was due to join his British counterpart, Dominic Raab, in London for a public conversation on the future of the special relationship, and that was also in quotes. At first glance, and despite the croonings of the Brexiteers, that relationship appears to be in poor shape. Thomas Wright of the Brookings Institution, a Washington think tank, describes it as, quote, in its worst state since the Suez Crisis, end quote, in 1956. Mr. Wright has cataloged many ways in which President Donald Trump tormented the previous government under Theresa May. Although Mr. Trump has better rapport with Mr. Johnson than he had with Mrs. May, tensions have not disappeared. Meanwhile, competition for America's attention has been growing. Under the energetic Emmanuel Macron, France emphasizes that it is the oldest ally of the United States. China's rise is also tugging America away from Europe. All this adds to a sense of uncertainty, post-Brexit, about Britain's status and role in the world. The so-called special relationship has always been lopsided. Helmut Schmidt, a German chancellor, once quipped that it was so special only one side knew it existed. But for nearly half a century, membership of the European Club allowed the British to stop fretting too much about their influence in the world. They were the bridge between the U.S. and Europe, as Tony Blair, one of the most enthusiastic proponents of the special relationship and an ardent Remainer, put it as Prime Minister in 1997. Britain could wield influence on both sides of the Atlantic. Now that the bridge is breaking, questions about Britain's power are back. Things have come to a pretty pass. After the Second World War, Britain struggled to find its place in America's shadow. Winston Churchill envisaged Britain as part of three great circles among the democracies: the Commonwealth, the English-speaking sphere, and a united Europe. In 1946, in a speech in Fulton, Missouri, he had proposed a special relationship with the United States, a fraternal association of English-speaking peoples involving not only kindred societies but military collaboration. Another prime minister, Harold Macmillan, patronizingly positioned Britain as playing Athens to America's Rome, teaching a vulgar, bustling people how to run a rising empire. None of this proved convincing. In 1962, Dean Acheson, a former American Secretary of State, concluded that Britain had lost an empire but not found a role. Its attempt to find one away from Europe, based on a special relationship with America and on being the head of a commonwealth, he said, was about played out. Joining what was then the European Economic Community in 1973 offered something of a solution. As Ray Seitz, an American ambassador to London, noted in a valedictory speech in 1994, if Britain's voice is less influential in Paris or Berlin, it is likely to be less influential in Washington. In Mr. Blair's formulation, strong in Europe and strong with the U.S., there is no choice between the two. Stronger with one means stronger with the other. Our romance is growing flat. Special or not, the relationship has often been fraught. Apart from the Suez debacle, friction arose between Harold Wilson and Lyndon Johnson over Wilson's refusal to support the war in Vietnam. Even Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan, who were so chummy that Reagan's successor, George H.W. Bush, said he was just smitten by her, fell out over America's invasion of Grenada in 1983. Yet, over the years, in several different spheres, America and Britain have grown closer. Some 28 Nobel Prizes have been awarded jointly to people from the two countries. British actors, such as Daniel Craig, are as likely to play an American detective in Hollywood movies as American ones, such as Renee Zellweger, are to put on plummy British accents to play characters such as Bridget Jones. The economic ties are especially deep. New York and London, the world's top two financial centers, are rivals, but they are also intertwined. Nearly a fifth of Britain's exports go to America, more than double the share going to Germany, the next biggest partner. America accounts for 15% of Britain's total trade. American investment in Britain supports an estimated 1.5 million jobs and 1.3 million vice versa. Britain attracts more than 10% of American foreign R&D. As much as anything, though, it is shared values and habits of cooperation that have bound Britain and America together. Britain, says Nicholas Burns, a former American ambassador to NATO, is the country we trusted the most and worked most closely with. At the State Department, where British diplomats enjoy a level of access afforded no other country, Britain was the most like-minded country with America and the first port of entry with the EU on many issues, according to Amanda Sloat, a Europe specialist who served there under the Obama administration. In an Emerson poll from October of 2019, 40% of Americans saw Britain as their country's most valuable ally and strategic partner, far ahead of next place Canada at just 22%. This closeness has often been evident at the top, starting with the wartime partnership between Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt. Whether it was the free market freedom championing of Thatcher and Reagan, or the war fighting of Mr. Blair and George W. Bush, British and American leaders have tended to act in tandem. One of the questions facing the special relationship today is whether or not the same will apply for Mr. Johnson and Mr. Trump. They have a lot in common. Perhaps unsurprisingly, they openly express admiration for one another. Yet other leaders, including Mr. Macron, have learned that it is unwise to place high hopes in a bromance with Mr. Trump. And if Mr. Trump expects that Mr. Johnson will go along with his wishes on issues such as the Iran nuclear deal or relations with China, he is likely to find himself disappointed. Mr. Johnson's own instincts may even lean towards European positions on many issues, from climate change to Ukraine. As long as the Trump administration remains in place, we appear to be more aligned with the Europeans on values and interests than with the United States, suggests Sir Peter Westmacott, a former British ambassador to Washington. Federica Mogherini, until recently the EU's foreign affairs representative, expects continuity too. Huawei provided a first test of Britain's post-Brexit policy. Now, two other areas will come to the fore, defense and trade. Traditionally, the Anglo-American relationship has been deepest in military, nuclear, and intelligence matters. Britain's armed forces have fought alongside their ally in every major campaign of the last three decades. The way we fight is nearly indistinguishable, says Philip Breedlove, a retired American general who served as NATO's Supreme Allied Commander Europe from 2013 to 2016. Partly, this is down to an unparalleled level of integration. Every major in the British Army goes through a course in America, and more than 1,000 British military and civilian defense staff are based across 29 American states. Some military assets are held virtually in common, while British defense firms are more closely involved than those of any other country in building the F-35 warplane. Britain also depends on America to build, sustain, and defray the costs of its nuclear arsenal. We'll pause here to just remind you that you're listening to The Economist magazine on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This program featuring articles from the February 1st through February 7th edition of the magazine. Returning now to this week's briefing, The Special Relationship, A Weaker Post-Brexit Britain Looks to America. Good luck with that. And we pick it up here. You like tomato and I like tomato. Their spooks lean heavily on one another too. Britain's Signals Intelligence Agency, GCHQ, and its American counterpart, the NSA, are bound by the Five Eyes Pact, which includes Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. Documents leaked by Edward Snowden, a former NSA contractor, showed that Britain had a sweet deal. America paid at least £100 million to GCHQ in 2009 through 12, and 60% of Britain's high-value intelligence was derived from the NSA. But the benefits are not one-sided. Michael Hayden, an ex-NSA director, once told his British counterpart that if Fort Meade, the NSA's Maryland headquarters, was to suffer a catastrophe, he planned to entrust the machinery of American electronic espionage to Britain. This strategic intimacy dates to the Second World War. However, it is not immutable. Corey Shaikh of the American Enterprise Institute, or AEI, a think tank, warns that, quote, Britain is perilously close to becoming just like any other Western military, rather than the preferred partner of the U.S. anytime rules need enforcing, end quote. In recent years, the sorest point has been British defense cuts. In 2015, Barack Obama demanded, in terms that would foreshadow Mr. Trump's rhetoric, that David Cameron, then Prime Minister, pay his fair share. General Ray Odierno, then head of the U.S. Army, said that he was very concerned by the belt tightening, which amounted to an 18% fall in real terms spending over the previous 5 years. Those warnings helped trigger a spending boost, but 3 years later, James Mattis, then Mr. Trump's defense secretary, fired another shot across the bow of his British counterpart. France and the U.S. have concluded that now is the time to significantly increase our investment in defense, he warned in a letter, adding ominously, it is in the best interest of both our nations for the U.K. to remain the U.S. partner of choice. That prompted another hurried injection of cash, but Britain has struggled to keep up. The size of its armed forces has fallen for 9 consecutive years. Brexit might lead to further reductions. Still, American diplomatic and military insiders tend to poo-poo the idea that the relationship is in crisis or that France could supplant Britain. The UK is still our most capable partner militarily and our most valuable partner politically, says Rachel Elhuis, who handled European and NATO policy at the Pentagon until 2018. However, there are some signs of wavering in Britain. On January 12th, Ben Wallace, Britain's defense secretary, questioned America's reliability as a partner. Britain was very dependent on American surveillance and air cover, warned Mr. Wallace. We need to diversify our assets, he added. British spending on American kit is already slated to run to $32 billion over the next decade, around 7% of the defense budget each year. But the options for diversification are limited. Brexit has left Britain cut out of a new European defense fund and a project to build a European satellite navigation system. Going it alone is pricey. A proposed British-built alternative constellation would cost around £5 billion. So Britain will have a lot to wrestle with as it conducts a comprehensive review of security, defense, and foreign policy. Mr. Johnson has promised it will be the most radical assessment since the end of the Cold War. But oh, if we call the whole thing off. The other test of the special relationship, on trade, is likely to be similarly fraught, all the more so given the rancor in Congress over the Huawei decision. Tom Cotton, a Republican on the U.S. Senate's Armed Services Committee, tweeted that, quote, I fear London has freed itself from Brussels only to cede sovereignty to Beijing. However, the desire for a deal is not in doubt. Both sides are aiming for a comprehensive free trade agreement, which could dismantle non-tariff barriers. Negotiators share an interest in strong intellectual property protection, recognition for each other's professional qualifications, and maintaining a free flow of data. If Britain really wanted, it could probably get a deal in relatively short order. America has a template trade deal that it tries to push on all of its negotiating partners. David Hennig of the European Center for International Political Economy, a think tank, reckons Britain could sign up to most of the text on tariff reductions and services without a hitch. As a gesture, the Americans could offer some special access to their public procurement market. Indeed, American officials have been helping to bring their British counterparts up to speed, in some cases informing them of stumbling blocks in negotiations with the EU. The warmth stems only partly from a genuine wish to strengthen their relationship. It also reflects a desire to thumb American noses at the EU and pull Britain away from its regulatory orbit. In some crucial areas, Britain is going to have to choose between the American system of regulation and the European one. Take the issue of food standards, often simplified to a debate about chlorinated chicken. The EU bans its import on the basis of the precautionary principle, which says that there must be scientific evidence proving something is safe for it to be allowed. America flips that burden of proof. In order for a product to be banned, there must be scientific evidence proving it is unsafe. American negotiators scoff that the EU's approach is unscientific. Regardless, if Britons opt for the American way, they may quickly find themselves embroiled in the EU's non-tariff barriers for their own products. The EU has made it clear that any future free trade deal with Britain will have to include provisions to prevent any unfair competitive advantage that Britain could get by undercutting its environmental and regulatory measures. To put it another way, if Britain wants to diverge from the EU's standards and follow an American model instead, its market access to its biggest and closest neighbor will suffer. If negotiators get bogged down, as they probably will, then they could aim instead for a quick and shallow deal, delivering political wins on both sides of the pond. Such a deal could diffuse the dispute over digital service taxes, or perhaps America's complaints over Britain's subsidies for Airbus, a European aircraft manufacturer. Despite these potential hurdles, leaving the EU does not mean Britain has lost all its leverage with the country Iran dubbed the Great Satan to Britain's Little Satan. Britain can still draw on a depth of diplomatic capital that offers it clout. It remains in the G7 and the G20 and plays a big role in NATO. Britain has a wide network through the Commonwealth and earns influence as a major player in development aid. Not least, it retains one of the five permanent seats on the UN Security Council. As the country emerges from agonizing over the Brexit negotiations, it can start to devote more energy to working out how to make the most of these assets under its new, semi-connected status with the continent. Indeed, whatever the intrinsic merits of the Huawei decision, the British view was that security risks should be managed and that the alternative suppliers were not yet up to scratch. It dispels the idea that a weakened Britain leaving the EU will always bend to America's will. When Britain ingratiates itself with America, things do not necessarily end well, as Mr. Blair's enthusiasm for the war in Iraq showed. A clear-headed view of the country's national interests, which in the Huawei case include Britain's wish for strong trade relations with China, serves it best. Outside the constraints of the EU, Britain could have some scope to be more agile. Take sanctions. It is true that Britain is losing the ability to champion these through the EU, but it also no longer has to be bound by the need to thrash out lowest common denominator agreements. It could, potentially, take the initiative on its own. Then that may break my heart. Some would like to see Britain take the lead in areas where, for now, America seems to have lost interest, such as championing democracy, though that would mean standing up to China. Because Britain knows America so well, it has a huge opportunity to help countries trying to deal with it do it more nimbly and more strategically, says Ms. Sheikh of the AEI. Britain could remain in the bridge business. The two countries may never regain the first-name closeness shared by Ron and Margaret or even George and Tony, but a different American administration could both rekindle something of that romance as well as help its ally remain closely connected with the continent. For now, however, Mr. Trump seems to favor a divide-and-conquer approach, and that threatens the ardor between Boris and Donald. You just heard this week's briefing, The Special Relationship. A weaker post-Brexit Britain looks to America. Good luck with that. Now, to Britain itself for another Brexit story, the feature article from the UK edition of the magazine, Uncharted Waters, Britain After Brexit. Now that Britain is sailing alone, Boris Johnson needs a lodestar. Liberalism offers one. Not much will change at 11 p.m. on January 31st. Some 50-page pieces proclaiming peace, prosperity, and friendship with all nations will go into circulation to mark Britain's departure from the European Union, But people, goods, and services will continue to move freely between Britain and the EU. For the difficult business of making a deal on trade and migration has been left to the transition period that lasts until the end of this year. Yet, leaving the EU is a huge moment. Britain will be quitting the institutional structure that governs Europe's single market, which will necessarily imply more friction in its trade relations with a club that takes almost half its exports. Britons will lose the automatic right they now have to live and work across the EU. Brexit has also administered a shock to the country. The nation has argued long and bitterly over the issue, and its ruling elite has suffered a blow. The inarguable outcome is the most powerful government in a generation under Boris Johnson. Much now depends on how he responds. The Economist did not advocate this outcome. Most of the changes that Mr. Johnson's government favors could have been accomplished without leaving the EU. System-wide shocks are usually a costly way to bring about change. Yet now that Brexit is definitely happening, the country should make the most of the chance to recalibrate the economy and reset its priorities. The last couple of times Britain pressed the reset button, in 1945 and 1979, the programs that it put into place to create the welfare state and replace socialism with Thatcherism had been long planned. This time is different. Mr. Johnson was focused entirely on leaving the EU and is now being buffeted by the storms that brew up swiftly in the affairs of state. He had to decide this week whether to bow to American demands that Britain keep Huawei, a Chinese company, out of its mobile phone network. He did not, and must shortly make a call on whether a high-speed rail project to link the north of England to the south, HS2, should go ahead. It should. Mr. Johnson grasps the excitement of the moment, but so far he has shown himself no more than a brilliant opportunist. If his premiership is to leave its mark, it needs to be founded on a strategic vision, not tactical campaigning. That vision should be based on liberalism. The belief in freedom as the underpinning of civilization, in the state as the servant of the individual rather than vice versa, and in the open exchange of goods, services, and opinions, arose in Britain. It fits naturally with a national character which suspects authority and tends toward pragmatism rather than idealism. It underpinned the country's progress in the 19th and 20th centuries and spread to become the world's dominant political philosophy. But it is now under threat, not least in Britain. Brexit was born in part of the instincts that to throw up barriers against the world. But within it was an ultra-liberal strand which regarded the EU as too statist and parochial. Mr. Johnson needs to unite the liberals and to persuade skeptics that a system based on free markets and free trade can work for them, too. Abroad, liberalism means using Britain's still considerable muscle in the service of free trade and individual rights, whether in backing the World Trade Organization or holding China to account for abuses in Xinjiang. Mr. Johnson's decision that the country should use Huawei's equipment was thus right. Liberalism means not going along with President Donald Trump's attempts to drive China out of global technology supply chains. Liberalism may also, on occasion, mean diverging from how the EU regulates business. In many areas, like manufacturing or food safety, following standards set in Brussels may be sensible even after Brexit, not least because the EU market is so valuable. In others, it may be a bad idea to accept the EU's rules. In financial services, competing EU financial centers may seek to use regulation to handicap the city. In science and technology, Britain's instinctive approach to regulation, which tends to be principles-based rather than relying on precaution, may be better suited to fostering innovation than the EU's. At home, liberalism means making the system open to all comers. Beneath the Brexit vote lay discontent that sprang from the sense that an economic system which pretends to be open is actually based on cronyism, run by and for a glossy, overpaid, London-based elite, impenetrable to those who are poor, provincial, and without a foot on the property ladder. Mr. Johnson's mantra is leveling up by boosting growth in the regions. He should be talking about opening up, to give everybody the opportunity to share in prosperity. That means encouraging social mobility by spending more money on children's early years, allowing the construction of more houses so that younger people can have decent homes, running an energetic competition policy to keep incumbents on their toes, and building roads and railways in areas that have been shortchanged. HS2 should be part of that. Although its estimated costs keep rocketing, the gains from boosting rail capacity and speed across Britain will outweigh them. Neither should the agenda be purely economic. Self-determination is central to liberalism, but over the past 150 years, power has slowly leached away from the English regions to Westminster. Scotland and Wales were given considerable autonomy in 1999, but England is highly centralized. Brexit was England's revenge on Westminster for giving special privileges to Scotland and Wales but ignoring the regions. And the consequence may yet be the breakup of the Union. But whatever the fate of the Union, a Liberal government needs to decentralize power, not just because decisions are best made as close to the action as possible, but because people need to feel they have power over their own destiny. Britain's future is full of uncertainty. No longer part of one of the great global blocs, it has to find a new role in the world. Pulled apart by the tensions within the Union, its nations need to find a new accommodation. Shaken by the bitter arguments over Brexit, it has to mend its frayed social contract. The difficulties should not be underestimated. But when Britain previously reset its course, in 1945 and 1979, the choices it made helped reshape the world. It should aim to do that again. And that was Uncharted Waters, Britain after Brexit. Now that Britain is sailing alone, Boris Johnson needs a lodestar. Liberalism offers one. Now we'll go to the Middle East for this. Dead on arrival, Donald Trump's one-sided peace plan. The need for new leadership on all sides has never been so clear. The prospect of peace between Israel and the Palestinians has grown so dim. It is easy to forget that President Donald Trump's effort to end the conflict began with much promise. The dealmaker-in-chief vowed to bring fresh thinking to the decades-old feud. As with any successful negotiation, both sides will have to make compromises, he told Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, in 2017. Mr. Trump's meeting with Mahmoud Abbas a few months later ended with the Palestinian president gushing, "With you, we have hope." What followed, though, was neither bold thinking nor any demand for sacrifices on both sides. Rather, Mr. Trump showered Mr. Netanyahu, a fellow populist, with political gifts. He recognized the disputed holy city of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. His State Department declared that Israeli settlements in the West Bank are lawful. Few legal scholars agree. Mr. Trump cut aid to the Palestinians, even for health and education, and closed their diplomatic mission in Washington. All this delighted his pro-Israel supporters back home, but enraged Palestinians. Such is the context for Mr. Trump's unveiling of his long-awaited peace plan with Mr. Netanyahu on January 28th. It will not bring peace, but it may spell the end of the two-state solution, the idea that a Palestinian state and a Jewish one might agree to coexist. At a different time, under a different president, the proposal might have been the starting point for more talks. Not an even-handed starting point, mind. The plan favors Israeli hardliners as no previous American plan has done. It lets Israel formally annex the settlements, hang on to the Jordan Valley, maintain control of holy sites, and reject Palestinian refugees. For the Palestinians, there are conditional promises of something like a state at some point in the future, with a capital on the outskirts of Jerusalem, plus billions of dollars of investment and an Israeli promise to freeze some settlement building. If they negotiate, they might get a better deal, suggests the Trump administration. The Palestinians do not believe it. If Mr. Trump were serious about peacemaking, why did he try to woo only one side? No Palestinian leader could have accepted the deal, let alone one as weak as Mr. Abbas. Mr. Trump did not even invite him to the unveiling. which anyway seemed designed to distract Americans from impeachment and Israelis from corruption charges against Mr. Netanyahu. The prime minister appears eager to end the Palestinian dream of statehood. He has already asked his cabinet to vote on annexing parts of the West Bank and is whipping up hawkish voters ahead of a tough election on March 2nd. Should Mr. Netanyahu win another term, he will undoubtedly move ahead with annexation. His main challenger, Benny Gantz, will face pressure to do the same if he is victorious. Far from easing the conflict, Mr. Trump has pushed it down a perilous path. He has given Israel a green light to take so much territory that a coherent Palestinian state is all but impossible. And he offers no viable alternative to the two-state solution. That may soon leave Israel with a choice. Give the Palestinians equal rights and watch as they multiply and outvote Jews, or treat them as second-class citizens and formally become an apartheid state. The best that can be said of the Trump plan is that it acknowledges the Oslo peace process is moribund and a new approach is needed. But a successful peace deal means not only discarding what has not worked, but also coming up with what will. A plan that demands concessions from both sides, as well as fair-minded leaders to implement it. This is not that plan. And Mr. Trump, Mr. Netanyahu, and Mr. Abbas are not those leaders. You just heard Dead on Arrival, Donald Trump's one-sided peace plan. The need for new leadership on all sides has never been so clear. And we'll conclude the program with this. Goldman Sachs, how the mighty Goldman has fallen. The bank's search for a new identity captures the changes in global banking. In its prime, Goldman Sachs was exceptional. 15 years ago, just before the global financial crisis, the bank easily outshone its Wall Street rivals, winning the most lucrative deals and making the most profitable trades. It printed money, both for shareholders and employees. Although the crisis imperiled the firm along with the rest of the banking industry, it navigated the chaos relatively well. Success allowed it to be haughty. While other banks engaged in the grubby game of sucking up to investors, Goldman remained secretive and enigmatic. How times have changed. This week, the firm held its first investor day, led by David Solomon, who took over as chief executive last year. It comes after a long period of underperformance. A dollar invested in Goldman in 2010 would be worth just $1.60 today. A dollar wagered on the S&P 500 would be worth $3.60, and on J.P. Morgan Chase, $4.10. Goldman has become a laggard. Its predicament reflects two big changes in Western banking. One is the declining profitability of capital markets activity, in large part the result of tighter rules, including higher capital requirements for riskier activity, penalties on lenders that rely on debt markets to fund themselves, and tighter compliance regimes. The second is the rising importance of technology in the industry, as consumers and corporate borrowers shift to digital banking. This appears to give an immediate advantage to very large lenders that can support huge IT budgets and to big tech platform firms that have vast numbers of customers who can be sold financial products, as is already the case in much of Asia. Goldman has been on the wrong side of these trends. Consider its performance relative to J.P. Morgan Chase, a giant full-service firm. Goldman is still wrestling with past compliance mistakes. It is expected to pay billions of dollars in penalties for the 1MDB scandal in Malaysia. Its funding costs are higher than J.P. Morgan Chase's, at 1.95% compared with 1.25% in 2018. Its ratio of expenses to revenues is worse. Not surprisingly, its return on tangible equity, a measure of profitability, was just 11% in 2019, compared with 19% for its rival. For Goldman's shareholders, the only consolation is that it has done better than Europe's flailing banks. In the most recently reported quarter, Barclays managed 10%, Credit Suisse 9%, and Deutsche Bank made a loss. Mr. Solomon's new plan is, in part, to become more like J.P. Morgan Chase, with a broader range of services and funding. Goldman wants to expand Marcus, its fast-growing consumer arm, and also to build out its transaction banking division that ships money around the world for companies. It plans to attract more deposits, which are typically the cheapest way to fund a bank. It has hired an army of tech experts. All this, Goldman hopes, will raise its return on tangible equity to 14%. Goldman says it recognizes the need for fundamental reform. It boasts of transforming its macho culture with a more diverse intake of recruits. But you can question how much it has really changed. It continues to allocate half its capital to its once-famed trading operation, despite its drab returns, and it still spends a lavish $12 billion a year on rewarding its staff, even as the firm earned only $8 billion for its shareholders in 2019. So far, investors remain skeptical, with its shares priced at their book value. If Goldman's reinvention fails, it may ultimately have to do a deal. Uniting Wells Fargo and Goldman, for example, would create something more like J.P. Morgan Chase, and with a similar-sized balance sheet. In America, regulators and some politicians are skeptical about bigger banks. In Europe, where the industry is more desperate, the mood has already changed, with matchmaking now encouraged. At least Goldman's mergers and acquisitions advisors will be in on any action. And that was Goldman Sachs, How the Mighty Goldman Has Fallen. The bank's search for a new identity captures the changes in global banking. And that brings us to the end of our time for this program. Over the past hour, you've been listening to articles from the February 1st through February 7th edition of The Economist, the weekly news magazine from Great Britain. I'm Steve Veitch, and it has been my pleasure to read them. Thanks again for listening. I'll be back in 2 weeks to share another edition of the magazine. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it with On Demand. In fact, you can listen to this and most other SunSounds programs at your convenience with On Demand. Just go to sunsounds.org and click on Broadcast Info and Audio.